From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tomorrow is the UN Security Council's deadline for Iran to suspend enriching uranium, which could be used for a nuclear weapon. Several neoconservatives and hardliners have been calling for regime change in Iran. Michael Ledeen says we can't win the war against Islamic fascism without defeating Iran. On today's Fresh Air, we'll ask Ledeen to make his case for regime change. He's with the American Enterprise Institute. We'll also talk with Joseph Cirincione, who emphasizes the importance of diplomacy. He's not sure if the Bush administration is serious about sanctions against Iran, or if it's calling for them only so it can later say, sanctions failed, it's time for regime change. Cirincione is with the Center for American Progress. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tomorrow is the deadline set by the UN Security Council for Iran to suspend uranium enrichment, a process that can be used for nuclear power production or to build a nuclear weapon. Some hardliners and neoconservatives are calling for airstrikes and/or regime change before Iran is able to develop a nuclear bomb. My guest Michael Adine has been calling for regime change in Iran for years, warning that Iran has been at war with us since 1979. He says the time for diplomacy is at an end. Adine is a contributing editor for the National Review Online and resident scholar in the Freedom Chair at the American Enterprise Institute. He's a former consultant to the National Security Council and the State and Defense Departments. Adine's latest book is The War Against the Terror Masters. In an earlier book, Perilous Statecraft, he wrote about his involvement in the Iran-Contra affair during the Reagan presidency. Michael Adine, welcome to Fresh Air. If Iran continues its nuclear program and doesn't comply with the UN Security Council, what do you think the United States should do?
Well, I think the nuclear question is a bit of a diversion. That is, the problem from Iran is that they are at war with us and have been at war with us for 27 years. And mainly what they do to us is kill us and our friends and allies all over the world. And that is the central issue that should drive American policy toward Iran, not whether they do or don't have nuclear weapons. And I think that the nuclear question should not drive the strategy we devise for Iran. And I think that since we're fighting a war against terrorism, that sooner or later we're going to have to bring down that regime in Tehran. And that's the central question. And I think it also resolves at least some of the main problems associated with nuclear weapons. That is, we don't worry much about pro-Western democratic countries that have nuclear weapons, countries like India or France or Great Britain. And I would not lose much sleep over a democratically elected government in Iran, because the Iranian people are overwhelmingly democratic and pro-Western and pro-American. What we worry about is nuclear weapons in the hands of these fanatics, these Islamic fascists.
Okay, so you've made it clear you'd like to see regime change in Iran, and you've been making that clear in your articles for a while now. How do you think the United States should go about that?
Same way we did with the Soviet Empire during the Cold War. That is, support the people who want to be free and who want to remove the regime. And we know how to do that. We've done it all over the world. It's a bit mysterious why we have never tried it in Iran, which is a country that famously has a very pro-American and anti-regime population. So basically, you do all the obvious things. First of all, you say, which the American government has never said, you say that you would like regime change in Iran. You would like a free government. And then you broadcast to them and you tell them every day that you want that, and you give them the information they need to be able to organize it effectively themselves. So we need to do for them what Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty did for the people in the Soviet Empire during the Cold War, that is, bring them up to date on what is going on elsewhere. So the people in Tehran need to know what's going on in Isfahan, Tabriz, Shiraz, etc. So then they need to hear from people who have participated in successful nonviolent revolutions around the world, so that they learn what works and what doesn't work, and they can learn from the experience of other people.
So you're making the argument that what the United States should do is help the Iranian people rise up and overthrow the current Iranian government and create
right.
a democracy there. This sounds very similar to the arguments that were made about Iraq before we invaded it. And, helping people overthrow the government didn't work there. We ended up invading Iraq. And although we were told that people would really love a democracy there and they'd welcome us, what we have now is chaos in Iraq. There's still an insurgency. There's a civil war or something near civil war, depending on who's doing the describing. And the war in Iraq appears to have turned a lot of people through the region against the United States. So I'm wondering what lessons you've taken away from Iraq.
Well, we disagree on almost every element of your analysis, I guess. We never did try to support revolution in Iraq. And I'm not aware of anybody. I think that you are the first person to have suggested that we did, that I've heard anyway. In fact, great chunks of the American government, particularly the State Department and the CIA, fought hammer and tongs against the very idea that one could have a revolution in Iraq. I disagreed with the military invasion of Iraq at the time. I thought it was a mistake. I thought it was the wrong way to do it. What I proposed was that since the Iraqi people could not possibly trust us, because another American president named George Bush had betrayed them barely 10 years before to Saddam by first calling for a Shiite and Kurdish uprising, and then when it occurred, doing nothing to protect them or defend them or support them, that they would have to see evidence that this time around we were serious. And so I suggested that we take those two no-fly zones, one in the north, one in the south, and turn them into free Iraq zones and let the Iraqis set up self-government in both of those areas, and then to call upon the rest of the Iraqi people in, let's call it Saddam's Iraq, and say to them, look, you don't have to die for this person, and we don't want to attack you. Get out. Go north. Go south. Live like free people, and you will see that we are here to liberate you and to create a free Iraq. So that was one point that I made. Just invading the country, I thought, was wrong. Secondly, I thought it was a mistake because it was an overly narrow vision of the war we were engaged in, which is a regional war in the Middle East. And anybody who was knowledgeable about the region, I thought, should recognize that if we invaded Iraq and brought down Saddam and occupied the country, that the Iranians and the Syrians were going to have to come after us. And in fact, they said so publicly before we ever went into Iraq. In fact, Bashar Assad gave an interview, open public interview, about 2 months before the start of Operation Iraqi Freedom, in which he said, when the Americans get there, that will only be the start. And then we will repeat in Iraq what we did to them earlier in Lebanon, which was the 1980s, when they, in fact, drove us out of Lebanon. And that's exactly what has happened.
So that is why you are arguing in your articles now that we not only need regime change in Iran, but in Syria, too. In fact, you call it Syran, because when you talk about regime change in Iran, you also talk about Syria. So you've conflated the two and just call it Syran now. So we've got a lot of work to do if we follow your game plan with changing regimes in Iran and Syria while continuing to
knows how much work there is to do. I wouldn't pretend to know that. It could happen very quickly. Life is full of surprises. And certainly one of the consequences of the downfall of Saddam and our occupation of Iraq has been to inspire people all over the region to want to do the same thing to their own leaders. Now, I remember about a week after Saddam fell, Le Monde sent some journalists into the streets of Tehran interviewing people, they said at random, and asking them, well, how do you feel about all these Marines running around Baghdad? And everybody gave the same answer, which was, why are they only in Baghdad? Why don't they come to Tehran? We love Marines here.
But that was a long time ago at the beginning of the invasion. My impression now from watching the news and reading the newspapers is that the war in Iraq has helped turn people throughout the Middle East against the United States. And doesn't this challenge in some way your feeling that Iran and Syria would be happy for a pro-American regime change? I get the impression we're not real popular there right now.
Well, I don't know why you have that impression, because even things like the Pew poll show that American popularity is rising and that the people of the region really do want to be free. It's a stereotype of a certain kind of reportage that people in that part of the world really don't want freedom, and they're not really set up for self-government and so forth. But I don't believe that.
Now, you're making it clear that you don't support military regime change in Iran and Syria. On the other hand, you write, our failure to support revolution makes military action more and more likely. How likely do you think a military action in Iran or Syria is right now?
I don't know. I'm not smart enough to answer that question. All I know is that the longer we avoid what seem to be moderate, sensible, traditional kinds of solutions to the problems we face in that region, the more likely it is that an American president will arrive one day at having to decide between appeasing a nuclear Iran and bombing it. And under those circumstances, bombing it is a real option.
As we've said, the way you'd like to support regime change in Iran is to help Iranian dissidents rise up and overthrow their own government. And before the invasion of Iraq, Ahmad Chalabi was considered to be one of the Iraqi exiles and dissidents who was informed about the Iraqi people and how they could, you know, rise up, and who gave a lot of information that was published in the press and that I think the Defense Department used to plan their strategy in Iraq. Now Chalabi is accused of having leaked American intelligence information to the Iranians.
Right.
So do you feel like... How betrayed do you feel by that?
Well, I don't think it's true. I can't imagine that it's true. I mean, this information comes from leaks from that same wonderful CIA who knew nothing about Iraq before we went in, and who has never really had a very good appreciation of what's going on inside Iran. I don't see why I should take that seriously. And he has offered to come and testify before Congress and answer all questions and so forth, and that offer has never been picked up. I think it's just a smear. He's been smeared a lot. And his theory that it was possible to do a lot more through revolutionary activity in Iraq has never been tested, so we can't evaluate it. And certainly he was opposed to this kind of invasion.
Let me read something that you wrote recently. You wrote, "Our failure to design and conduct a serious Iran policy for so long has narrowed our options, and we may be faced with a choice among various unattractive actions. If we and our allies decide that Iranian nuclear facilities must be taken out, we should first make clear to the Iranian people that we have come slowly and reluctantly to this position, and that the regime could have avoided this terrible situation by negotiating in good faith, and that we would never dream of doing such a thing if Iran were governed by reasonable people." It sounds there like you're thinking, even though you don't support military action, that maybe it's going to happen, and when it does, we should explain it to the Iranian people.
I believe that if we are faced with those alternatives, that it will mean that we've failed and failed to design a rational, sensible strategy toward dealing with Iran. I find it incredible that after 6 years in office, the Bush administration still has no Iran policy. Don't you? I mean, I think it's just amazing. Iran is arguably the central issue of the facing us in the Middle East. And we still have there's no document defining what our strategy is. There's no mission statement for what it is that we're supposed to be accomplishing there. We're just dithering around, bouncing from today's news to tomorrow's news. And that, to me, that's unacceptable. That's not the way a serious government is supposed to behave.
But it sounds from that quote that I just read that you're kind of expecting some kind of military action.
Well, I haven't seen any sign of anybody drafting a sensible policy. And I think that if you have no sensible policy, you are ultimately faced with terrible alternatives. And we may well end up there. Look, I am not a prophet. And prophecy is a very dangerous business. I'm an historian. And looking at the history of policymaking on this kind of question, when you come to dreadful alternatives, if you just look back a bit, you can see that if you had acted earlier and more moderately, you didn't have to deal with that sort of alternative. That's what I'm worried about.
My guest is Michael Ledeen of the American Enterprise Institute. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Michael Ledeen, a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. We're talking about why he's pushing for regime change in Iran. You've been supporting regime change in Iran for a long time. What do you think the consequences to the United States will be if there is not regime change?
We'll continue to be faced with this extremely hostile regime, which I think I was the first person to call a clerical fascist regime, which I wrote back in 1979. And they will continue to wage war against us in their way, and they will continue until they have either won or lost. It's not a very pleasant scenario, but I think it's as close to a sure thing as I can imagine.
So you see Iran in the context of a larger battle between the West and extreme Islam, and I mean, do you see this as a fight to the death?
I didn't say that, and I'm not sure I believe that. I don't see this as a war between Islam and the West, and I disagree with people who take that position.
I'm sorry if I'm misinterpreting you. That's how it was sounding.
Yeah, no,
me.
I was talking about Iran, and I was calling the Iranian regime a clerical fascist regime. Khomeini is a classical clerical fascist. I mean, I wrote my doctoral dissertation and several books about fascism, and in the scholarly literature, there is a category of fascism which is called clerical fascism, which was originally applied, by the way, to Christian clerical fascists in Romania at the same time as the Third Reich and Mussolini and so forth. But the and Khomeini fits that model of fascism perfectly, and this regime is exactly that. So I think Senator Santorum, for example, is well within his rights to talk about Islamic fascism. I think that's technically correct. But I'm just talking, you asked me a question about Iran, and I was answering a question about Iran. I wasn't talking about Islam in general. I don't think that Islam is predestined to wage jihad against the West forever. I think there is at the moment a strain of Islam which is jihadist and which is waging war against us, but I don't think it was inevitable, and I don't think there's any reason why it has to continue.
But just, again, getting back to the consequences that you think we will face if we don't have regime change in Iran, do you see Iran's extremist Islamic leadership spreading? Do you think it's already spread? I mean, what do you think will be the larger impact if the current regime remains in power?
I can't answer that. I don't know what will happen. Nobody knows what will happen. All we can say with certainty, I think this is as close to certainty as you can have, is that they have been attacking us for 27 years and they will continue to attack us. Everything they say leads to that conclusion. Everything they do leads to that conclusion. Why would you think that anything other than that will happen?
But when you say they've been attacking us for 27 years, I mean, do you hold Iran responsible for al-Qaeda, which is the group that actually attacked us on American soil?
How shall I answer this? All I said was that Iran has been attacking us for 27 years. I didn't say that Iran is responsible for every attack against us.
No, but the attack that's happened on American soil was the one by al-Qaeda.
Well, I'm not sure. Maybe there was a relationship between Iran and al-Qaeda, but I'm not making that accusation. I'm simply saying...
When you said they've attacked us for 27 years, what are the attacks that you're referring to?
Well, how many would you like? There was the seizure of the hostages in Tehran. There was the bombing of the American embassy in Beirut. There was the bombing of the American Marine barrack in Beirut. There was the attack against Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia.
So you've named like four or five attacks.
Well, I can name more, but you know,
years.
we don't have all day. But there's an awful lot. There are the attacks against American forces in Iraq today, which are heavily supported by Iran. The IEDs that are blowing up American troops along highways in Iraq are manufactured in Iran and come in from Iran as well as from Syria. There are Iranian Revolutionary Guards intelligence officers all over Iran. Israel found that when they went into Lebanon, they found Iranian military intelligence officers standing alongside Hezbollah.
Are there any final thoughts you'd like to leave us with?
You bet. The thing that most perplexes me about the policy debate in the United States these days, and it's been true for several years, is how it is that people who hold the views that I hold, which are to support democratic revolution all over the world, not just in Iran, but all over the world, have come somehow to be called conservatives, when revolution is, by definition, a radical event. It's the opposite of conservatism. It calls for fundamental change. And I can compare it to a question that Leo Strauss once asked about the word virtue. He said, how did it happen that a word, virtue, that used to stand for the manliness of men, came to mean the virginity of women or the chastity of women, which is a very dramatic change. And so it is that you have a lot of people today who are advocating revolution and support for democratic revolution against tyranny have come to be mystified, I would argue, as conservatives. And it's perplexing. And I think it shows the degree to which people really have trouble understanding what is going on and the implications of various kinds of policy prescriptions.
Do you think of yourself as a revolutionary?
Well, sure. I'm advocating revolution. I've advocated revolution all my life.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Michael Ledeen is a scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and a contributing editor for the National Review Online. We'll hear the case for diplomacy with Iran in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Half Broken Things, a novel of psychological suspense by Morag Yass, author of Fruitful Bodies, and from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, dealing with Iran and its uranium enrichment program, we talk with Joseph Cirincione of the Center for American Progress. He emphasizes the importance of diplomacy, but he's not sure if the Bush administration sees sanctions as just a step along the way to regime change. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the first part of our show, Michael Ledeen made the case for regime change in Iran. My guest, Joseph Cirincione, thinks diplomacy is essential in dealing with Iran and its uranium enrichment program. Tomorrow is the deadline the UN Security Council has set for Iran to suspend its uranium enrichment program. That program could be used for nuclear power or a nuclear weapon. Cirincione thinks there's no chance that Iran will comply with the Security Council's deadline, and its refusal will likely result in sanctions against Iran. Cirincione is Senior Vice President for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress. He spent 8 years as the Director for Nonproliferation at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. So what do you think the odds are that the sanctions will be effective and Iran will back down and stop, you know, its nuclear program and talk?
I don't think there's any chance that Iran is going to stop its uranium enrichment activities. If I had to guess, I would say that we're going to find a compromise that would allow negotiations to begin while Iran engages in some level of uranium enrichment activity. But that's just a guess, and a lot will depend on what the real agenda of the United States is in this matter. Is it really interested in shutting down Iran's enrichment program, or is the game really about regime change in Iran and the nuclear program is just the vehicle for achieving that regime change?
What leads you to think that the sanctions might just be a vehicle for ultimately pursuing regime change?
I think right now there are two factions in the administration with different agendas, both playing out at the United Nations. So on the surface, the United States is being very calm, very measured, not engaging in a lot of inflammatory rhetoric on Iran, talking very softly about this, trying to keep together the coalition that has passed the resolution so far, hoping that a slow, steady escalation of pressure will force Iran to back down. I think some in the State Department, that is what you might call the pragmatists in the administration, are hoping that this will in fact work, that there will be some way of beginning negotiations with Iran, and we can conclude if not a grand bargain, a new relationship with Iran, at least an end to the objectionable parts of its nuclear program, specifically those enrichment technologies that could be used for fuel rods, but also for nuclear bombs. But there's another faction in the department, in the administration, primarily led by Vice President Cheney and those in his office, but also some of the National Security Council, some around Secretary Rumsfeld, who believe that there's no negotiating with these people, that Iran is already determined to go build a nuclear weapon, that it's racing to do so, and that we have a choice between military action to stop that program or acquiescing to the Iranian nuclear bomb. They say the latter is completely unacceptable, and the only reason they're engaging in these talks is to basically dance the dance that they did with Iraq in 2002, to make it appear as if the U.S. is going the last mile. The U.S. is the reasonable partner trying diplomacy. Diplomacy fails. It tries sanctions. Sanctions fail. We'll be left, they say, with only the military option. I think that is honestly the agenda of a good faction in the administration, and we don't know yet whether that faction will win out or not.
So is that faction pushing for a military strike against the nuclear program, in other words, nuclear targets? Or is it pushing for the larger thing, which is regime change in Iran?
It's regime change. And you can tell this by just reading the neoconservative press. The same folks who got us into the war in Iraq are now beating the drum for a war with Iran. I'm talking about William Kristol with the Weekly Standard, or Richard Pearl, who had an op-ed along these lines in the Washington Post back in July, Michael Rubin from the American Enterprise Institute, folks like this. The National Review online has a long extended essay this week talking about the need for overthrow of the Iranian regime and for using military means for that purpose. This has always been the view of at least some in the administration, that the great historic struggle facing us now was this struggle against this radical Islam, that this was a true clash of civilizations, and that we, the United States, were the forces of enlightenment, the forces of freedom and democracy, and it was up to us to use our military power to resist and to crush this, what Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld calls the new fascism. And that we're in exactly the same situation today as the U.S., the West, was in facing the Nazi threat in the 1930s, and that we have to be prepared for war. And, in fact, they say we're already at war. Now the question is completing that war, not retreating from this threat. So for them, Iran is Nazi Germany. Ahmadinejad is Hitler. They are Churchill, and they intend to take down that new threat.
And what do you think of that analysis?
I think that is grandiose paranoia. I think they're inflating both the threat and their own role in history. The Iranian regime is a despicable regime, despised by many Iranians themselves, but it is not an expansionist, aggressive power in any way comparable to that of Nazi Germany, or for that matter, Soviet communism. It is a a regional problem, you might even say a national problem within Iran, but it does not pose this existential or crushing threat. Basically, I think that those in the administration who think this way, those in the neoconservative movement who think this way, are struggling with the historic problem that has plagued Americans for decades, that is the failure to understand the nature of nationalism, to understand that many of the fights that we're engaged in are not against communism or against Islamic fundamentalism. It's against nationalism. We're seeing nationalist uprisings in the Middle East, and we're mistaking that and mislabeling it as this great ism, this ideological thought, this ideological current that we have to defeat. And in so doing, we're misunderstanding the nature of the struggle we're engaged in. We're making a big strategic error and therefore employing the wrong tactics, the wrong tools, the entire wrong orientation for how to defeat this challenge.
But a lot of people look at the Middle East now and say that Arabism, you know, and identification as Arabs is being replaced by Islamism, by an extremist form of Islam. And that the popularity of Hezbollah is a good example of that.
I think that Arab nationalism has been frustrated for years. It's been, the Arabs have been struggling for decades, first against the Ottomans, then against the British and the French, who came in with their imperialist rule after that. And the U.S. in some senses has inherited that 19th century, early 20th century imperialist baggage. And for the neoconservatives, they're embracing it. They say, yes, you know, we're going to do it better than the British and the French. We will determine the future of this region in a way that the British and the French never could. And the Arabs have tried, have expressed their nationalism with various forms. There was the Nasserism, the pan-Arabism of the 50s and 60s. There was communism that came in, various kinds of socialism. All of them have failed to really deliver what the Arabs were looking for, which is self-determination, democracy of a kind, and prosperity and advancement, with the kind of things that all peoples want. And now this religious ideology is promising to be the path out, and I believe it's sort of the form that this nationalism is taking. They're clutching on to this Islamic ideology in the belief that, well, maybe this is the way out.
So you're saying that when you hear the neocons' argument comparing Iran to Germany during World War II, to Germany's expansionist vision in World War II, you don't think that that comparison holds. But what about the fact that Iran is funding Hezbollah in Lebanon? Iran seems to be funding some of the Shiites in the insurgency and in the civil war in Iraq. Correct me if I'm wrong on that in Iraq, but isn't that signs of Iran's expansionist views?
Well, Iran is the largest, most powerful country in the region. Of course it's going to try to exert its influence and extend its influence throughout the region. It always has and it always will. That's part of what it means to be dealing with Iran. Hezbollah has been defined by Israel, and we've now accepted this as a terrorist organization, but that doesn't mean they're al-Qaeda. They are not al-Qaeda. Hezbollah, at least in the last 15 years, has not attacked the United States. We have part of the danger here is to get this all mixed up in this Islamic fundamentalist, Islamic fascist mush and see them all, that they're all together, that al-Qaeda is Hamas, is Iran, is al-Qaeda, is Syria. They're all our enemy. We have to fight them all. Nonsense. Nonsense. We should keep our eye on our real enemy. It's al-Qaeda. Those are the people who attacked us on September 11th, not Iraq, not Iran, not Hamas, not Hezbollah. If we had kept our eye on bin Laden, we would have defeated him by now. And we wouldn't have created this mess, this chaos in the Middle East that is providing opportunities for the troublemakers like Ahmadinejad and Hassan Nasrallah.
My guest is Joseph Cirincione of the Center for American Progress. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joseph Cirincione of the Center for American Progress. He's written extensively about nuclear politics and nonproliferation. We're talking about how to deal with Iran. Now, let's get back to the push for regime change. You said that you've been reading a lot of neoconservatives in the press beating the drum for regime change. Let me quote William Crystal, the editor of the Weekly Standard. From the July 24th edition, he wrote, "Why wait? Does anyone think a nuclear Iran can be contained, that the current regime will negotiate in good faith? It would be easier to act sooner rather than later." Although you basically disagree with Crystal, do you think that there's an element of truth to that, that if Iran's going to get a nuclear bomb, it's going to be easier to act sooner than later?
There's nothing inevitable about Iran getting a nuclear bomb. For one thing, they are years away from it. And this is the lesson we have to learn from Iraq. There's nothing wrong with making a worst-case scenario for the purposes of planning, if we're trying to imagine what could happen in the future. The mistake is acting on that worst-case assumption. This is what Ron Suskind calls the 1% doctrine. If there's a 1% chance that Iran could get the bomb and give it to a terrorist group and deliver it to New York, shouldn't we overthrow the regime? That is the guiding principle that guides William Crystal and the neoconservatives that still seem to have such a strong influence in this administration, despite the abject failure of their military adventure in Iraq. They believe that if Iran's going to get the bomb eventually, that's posited as a certainty, therefore we must invade. Iran is a good 10 years away from the ability to make a nuclear weapon. That is the judgment of many experts, and it, in fact, is currently the judgment of the intelligence agencies, the National Intelligence Estimate that was done just last year and reported a year ago in the Washington Post. It concludes that Iran is 5 to 10 years away, most likely 10 years, from the ability to make a bomb. That tells you that we've got time to work out a diplomatic solution, time to put some conditions, some constraints on this program, and to develop a more effective policy that could actually empower the Iranian people themselves to make the regime change that, in the end, only they can make. This is not a popular regime in Iran. This is an imposed regime that has failed over the last 30 years to satisfy the basic needs of the Iranian people for good jobs, for security, for openings to the rest of the world, the kinds of things the Iranians want. Anybody who's been to Iran, and I was there just last year, knows that at least in the urban areas, this is an intensely pro-Western population who listen to American rock songs and buy bootlegged American movies on DVD and have satellite dishes sprouting from their roofs. They want to be part of the rest of the world, and they resent the regime for keeping them, in a sense, prisoners. If we can take this nuclear issue away from the regime and stop Ahmadinejad from riding this issue as a nationalist cause, which is exactly the way he's manipulated it in the last year, then the regime has to stand only on its ability to deliver the goods, and it can't deliver the goods.
What about the track record that we have in Iran? I mean, we helped overthrow the Mossadegh government, the democratically elected Mossadegh government in 1953, and to install the Shah. So what is our history of regime change like in Iran?
I would say very few people in America remember that the United States and the British cooperated to overthrow the democratically elected government in Iran in 1953, and that almost everyone in Iran remembers that. They remember the Shah. People lived through the brutal regime of the Shah. He was our guy in Iran. We were going to make Iran into the policeman of the Gulf. That was our idea. So when the Shah proposed in a very extensive civilian nuclear power program, we approved it. The Shah wanted to build 20 nuclear reactors. That's what the government says they want to build now. We okayed it. In fact, we wanted to sell him those reactors. Even when the CIA discovered in the 70s that the Shah was secretly working on a nuclear weapons program, we still okayed Iran's plans then to open up a uranium enrichment facility and a plutonium reprocessing facility. We went ahead with that because we said that was okay. He's our guy. When the Shah was overthrown in 1979, the Islamic Republic that came in then shut down those programs. They wanted no part of Western technology. They considered this to be a weakness, and they wanted Iran to be self-reliant. When Iraq invaded Iran in 1981, the Islamic Republic reconsidered that, and that's when we believe the program restarted. The Iranians know this. They understand this history, and they constantly accuse the U.S. of a double standard, of wanting to dictate to Iran what they can and can't do. And that's why this issue is so powerful within Iran. That's why the majority of the Iranian people support Iran's right to this technology, not to nuclear weapons. That's not what they're saying in Iran, the right to this technology. They see nuclear power as the power of the future, in part because we keep telling them it is, and that they have a right to do it, and they're going to resist Western efforts to restrict Iran's rights. We have to take this issue away from the nationalist cause, disconnect it, and find a compromise that can allow Iran to go ahead with the construction of nuclear power facilities, but impose restraints and monitoring on any programs that might someday lead it to a nuclear weapons technology. Fortunately, we have time to do this if we can just get our own strategy straight.
My guest is Joseph Cirincione of the Center for American Progress. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joseph Cirincione of the Center for American Progress. He's written extensively about nuclear politics and nonproliferation. We're talking about how to deal with Iran. So there are people who you've described as the neoconservatives calling for a military approach to regime change. Other people are calling for regime change through helping people in Iran overthrow the government. And I guess you'd put yourself in that camp. What does it do you think, to the government in Iran to hear all these calls from the United States about regime change? Like, what position do you think that puts them in? And how does that affect, do you think, like, Iran stands toward the UN Security Council now?
I'll tell you exactly what they think, because I've talked to Iranians, and they tell me this. They believe that the Bush administration wants to overthrow their government and that the nuclear issue is just the excuse for doing it. Therefore, they say there's nothing we can do to appease the United States. If we stop enriching uranium, that it's not going to satisfy the United States. They're going to come after us anyway. And they recognize that that would make them look weak, and they would lose points both with their own people and with they would appear weak to other rivals in the region. So why should we do that, they argue? And in fact, if we just stick to our guns, the U.S. itself will back down. That's the only way we're going to guarantee the security of our country. And if the U.S. comes ahead with an attack, we can withstand the attack. We can take the attack just like Hezbollah took the attack, because in the end, air power isn't enough to defeat Iran. And the U.S. doesn't have the ground troops to go in. So they calculate this all out, and they think they come out the winner. That's why they're acting the way they are. That's why they're not giving up. So the only way to crack that is for the United States to explicitly reject a policy of regime change in Iran, to explicitly hold out the possibility of diplomatic recognition of Iran, of being willing to come to some kind of limited detente with this regime. Unfortunately, that's exactly what the neoconservatives don't want to happen.
Do you want to see the United States completely reject the policy of regime change, having just said what you did that you'd like to see the United States help Iranians change the regime?
we have to give up the idea that it's up to us to determine what governments other countries have, that it's up to us to somehow overthrow or empower these other regimes. We have to be helping the people of those countries determine their governments for themselves. That's the only method that has ever worked. That's the only one that can work now.
Do you think that your reading of President Ahmadinejad's reaction, which is that why should he give in? Because the United States is going to do regime change anyway, so why not just like hang in there? Do you think that that's a pretty accurate reading, that the United States will eventually try regime change?
That's tough to answer because even though we have a democracy, it doesn't mean our government's transparent. We don't really understand the decision-making that's going on inside the White House. And I hear two things, frankly, in the Washington rumor mill. One, I hear that the U.S. has its hands full with Iraq, which is a failed war, and Afghanistan, which is a failing war, and there's no stomach for further military adventures. And the other that I hear, and there's some press reports like Cy Hirsch's article in The New Yorker about things like this, that the administration has already decided to take a military strike on Iran and that the military is trying to convince it out of taking such a strike. I don't know which of these is true, but I believe that this dynamic exists, that there are at least some in the administration who have already decided, and this is the way somebody put it to me, that we've already lost the American people, so we might as well do the right thing. That no matter what happens in the November elections, win or lose, they believe that in 2007 the time is right for a strike against Iran to try and roll the dice and to, you know, shatter the status quo, toss the pieces up in the air, and hope that good things happen. And what gives that kind of story, those rumors, credibility to me is that that's what they've done in the past, that this is the way I know many of these people think. That the status quo, stability, is our enemy, that we're the engine for change, that the U.S. military is the instrument that will bring change and democracy to the region, and they're willing to use it even in what many of us would consider utterly reckless ways.
There was a recent article in Rolling Stone magazine by James Bamford, who has written extensively about the National Security Agency. And in that this is about regime change in Iran, and in that article he writes that in November 2003, Donald Rumsfeld approved a plan which for the first time established a preemptive strike capability against Iran. And in 2004, that was followed by a top-secret interim global strike alert order that put the military on a state of readiness to launch an airborne and missile attack against Iran should Bush issue the command. Do you know anything about this?
I've heard that story from several people that I trust, and it makes me believe that it's true, and that in addition to that, there have been reports that Cy Hirsch reported on earlier this year about U.S. Special Operations Forces actually being inside Iran, and just this week I spoke to a consultant for the Pentagon who confirmed that to me personally, that we've had covert forces operating inside Iran for almost 2 years now, in part to aid groups operating in the north and south of Iran, and in part to conduct reconnaissance on nuclear facility and possible strike targets. So the U.S. has more going on, both on the planning level and on covert operations with Iran, than most people realize, and maybe more than Congress realizes. All of this underscores the necessity for Congress to reestablish its oversight authority and hold some hearings, not just on the war in Iraq and in Afghanistan, but on the possible war with Iran.
What do you think the consequences would be if we had a military strike on Iran, or if we, through the military, tried to impose regime change?
Bang. That is the billion-dollar question. We have to learn from Iraq. We have to understand that there's more to it than just doing the strike. What happens after the strike? And then what happens after that? And there are a dozen things that Iran could do that would make life very, very uncomfortable for us. For example, strikes at shipping going through the Straits of Hormuz that would immediately shut down a major oil supply line in the world, oil would scream past $100 a barrel. Some experts talk about $200 a barrel. That means gasoline goes to $4, maybe $5, maybe $6 a gallon. Almost certainly that plunges most of the Western world, and in fact most of the world, since China's so dependent, into some kind of recession. There's also the possibility that there are military strikes throughout the region, that the Shia militia in southern Iraq, for example, which have so far not attacked U.S. forces, now rise up against U.S. forces. You could see Hezbollah engage in activities, perhaps against Israel, perhaps against U.S. targets in the region. There are other similar sort of asymmetrical responses that could happen that have to be calculated out when you think about the consequences of a strike, the risks of a strike, what kind of world we would be producing with military strikes on Iran.
Joseph Cerencioni, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. It's always a treat to be on your show. Thank you for having me.
Joseph Cerencioni is Senior Vice President for National Security and International Policy at the Center for American Progress. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chilog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Minhivar. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, available in stores and online at bn.com. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And from the Cato Charitable Foundation, advancing environmental values and saluting all those who work to sustain our world. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Fresh Air is celebrating the extended holiday weekend with a country music series. Our series begins on the next Fresh Air with the Dixie Chicks and father and son singers and songwriters Daryl and Wayne Scott. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
I'm famous to my friends and family, to my friends and family. I'm a household name. They all know.